This is Joe Alexander from Barely Human on YouTube, and you're listening to Sync Book Radio from thesyncbook.com.
I got interested in the Pooka because there are so many fascinating stories about him, and I especially am fond of County Kerry logic. I heard a County Kerry farmer being interviewed on Irish radio, and the interviewer, a Dublin University man, asked him, "Do you believe in the Pooka?" And he said, "That I do not, and I doubt much that the Pooka believes in me either." That's a relief from the rather monotonous mechanical logic of PsychCop. I don't believe in the Pooka either, and I doubt that the Pooka believes in me. But it is curious that in England they've got a six-foot rabbit too in Cornwall. He's called Bunny Man, and he's been reported for centuries. One of the most recent Bunny Man sightings was in an English magazine called Common Cause a couple of years ago. A woman coming home late from work saw a UFO in the woods, and the light came toward her. The light was getting brighter, and like many people who've had UFO experiences, she was frightened and started running, and she ran right into the six-foot-tall white rabbit, who said, "Please pray for me." Well, that's what she thought happened. That's her reality tunnel. That's how she could describe her experience that night. And that got me interested in the whole science of lepoofology. Lepoofology is the conjunction of rabbits with UFOs. There's a whole society devoted to studying lepoofology. It's not just one of my fantasies. There's a group called MEBON, the Mutual Easter Bunny Observation Network. They're a splinter off MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. Jacques Vallée is one of the major proponents of the theory that human belief systems create UFOs. And Carl Jung had a variation on that theory in his book on flying saucers. So MEBON decided to see if human expectations would create Easter Bunny sightings. And they started asking other people in the UFO field, whatever that is, whether it's a hobby or a science or a new religion, I don't know. But they started sending out questionnaires if people had any Easter Bunny sightings for them. And they got back a lot of answers. People didn't have Easter Bunny sightings, but they had mysterious conjunctions, synchronicities, Jung would say. Mysterious conjunctions of UFOs and rabbits. For instance, there's a farmer in Isola, Italy, who says that a giant cigar-shaped UFO landed in his backyard. A bunch of dwarfs got out, and they took all the rabbits from his rabbit hutch and took off. Maybe UFOs come here to get the makings for rabbit stew. J. Allen Hynek, very distinguished astronomer, who was the consultant to the Air Force's UFO investigation. Hynek, in his book, The Edge of Reality, tells about a case in Iowa where at the site of a UFO sighting, where there was a burn mark on the ground, as is often found, all around the burn mark, they found hundreds and hundreds of paralyzed rabbits. And on a more sinister note, north of Chicago, after a UFO sighting, they found mutilated cattle, as is happening increasingly in these cases, UFO sightings and mutilated cattle, but they also found a beheaded rabbit. And there's a case on record of an abductee, a woman who claimed to be abducted by a UFO. She said the pilot of the UFO was a giant rabbit. We get hundreds of millions of signals every second through our various sense organs, and our brains orchestrate them in accordance with our reality tunnel, the way we prefer to put things together. I don't think there's any reality tunnel that's all right and any that's all wrong, so I'm not an Aristotelian thinker. So I take this data about lepoofology as just an example of an emerging reality tunnel. And it's appearing in the arts, too. The first UFO abductee was not a human being. The first UFO abductee was in a movie, and it was Bugs Bunny. In a 1952 movie called Hasty Hair, Bugs was kidnapped by a UFO. And that was about 6 years before the first human came forth to claim that a UFO abduction. And if you see Spielberg's E.T., the first shot you see is a rabbit before you see the UFO. Also, in the old film, It Came from Outer Space with Richard Carlson, when the spaceship lands, the first thing you see is a rabbit running away. And the lepoophological correlation is very deep. The Fire Sign Theater and their album, Not Insane, they have a letter in there from a rabbit, and it's dated Deep Space. While PsyCop and the other fundamentalist materialists are busy denouncing parapsychology, there are much weirder things going on than ESP. People are having extraterrestrial experiences with rabbits.
Today obviously is because it's August 8th, and I wanted to sort of acknowledge the 88, as in 88 miles per hour.
Yes.
Have you seen at all recently One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
I'm pretty familiar with it. I think the last time I saw it was maybe within the last 18 months.
Okay, cool.
I guess that's relatively recent. Yeah.
I found myself watching it recent, just in the last week, specifically because, well, there's actually a whole bunch of syncs around why I watched it. But one of the things that stood out to me was I didn't realize that was Christopher Lloyd's first major film role.
Right, right.
And there was a scene in there that struck me as interesting was at some point they're tossing a cigarette around, and like there's this one guy like it has a cigarette, and the nurse tells him to put it out or something, and they're like trying to steal it, and it gets tossed around, and then at some point it ends up falling into Chris Floyd's pants leg, and he doesn't realize it for a few minutes, and then as time goes on, suddenly his foot starts to burn, and he starts screaming and hopping around because his foot's on fire. And I couldn't help but think of the end of Back to the Future, where you have him running through the flames, the sort of Olympic torch scene.
Oh, yeah.
And him with the flames around his feet. I don't know if that does anything for anybody, but that's something that that struck me as pretty interesting.
Huh. No, yeah, that is cool. I'm trying to build, some more loose connections. Like, for some reason, his face when he's reacting to the fire in his laboratory, if I'm not mistaken, is pretty similar to his overall reaction to the cigarette. I'm trying to remember what the cigarette scene looks like too. So I don't know if you remember when he drives the car into the toy car into the trash can.
Yeah.
And he kind of freaks out in the same manner that he freaks out with the cigarette. Obviously, it would be similar. It's the same guy.
But he has I guess I'm not sure what exactly it would be, but there seems to be something. You've made a very convincing argument of Christopher Lloyd resonating with Zeus. It's interesting to me that he would have the sort of flames about him, and again, I don't know if it's necessarily flames just at the feet, or if this continues with the torch idea. I'm just wondering if there's another angle. Or even if we could even take that as the sort of, since you have him as the Christ bearer, is this him sort of walking through the flames of hell or something along those lines? I'm not trying to read too much into it. I'm just trying to figure out, like, when I realize, okay, there's this other commonality, this other common imagery. I guess I'm just trying to throw that out there if that speaks to anybody. And if not, it might not. We might not figure out what it means for 6 months, so who knows?
I think fire is definitely something, but I my mind right now when they go fishing, and I was trying to count in my head how many of them are going fishing. I doubt it's 12 or 13. If it was it was 13, that'd be pretty good. I can't remember how many are on the boat. You know,
I believe it's 9. Because when they have the scene where they take a vote, he's saying, they make a point about saying that only 9 of them voted, and she says, and there's 18 men on the ward.
Right.
So that means there's 9 of them that are able enough to actually, functional enough to actually leave. Which was interesting.
I'm sorry, my fault.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say it struck me as resonating with the idea of the Aeneid, like these 9 gods, particularly that they get on the yellow bus. I just watched Little Miss Sunshine with the yellow bus, blah, blah, blah. But the idea of this Aeneid, the 9 gods traveling on the boat together is a heavy Egyptian motif.
You know why flew over the cuckoo's
nest? Excuse me?
Flew over the cuckoo's nest? Because cuckoos will infiltrate other birds' nests and take advantage of getting fed with the other birds.
Mm.
So a cuckoo will drop their egg into some foreign bird's nest so that it'll get raised by the other birds. And it often ends up pushing the other birds out of the nest and taking over.
Oh, like, beautiful.
Jesus.
That's an awesome bird.
Right, so Jack Nicholson is the cuckoo. He's infiltrating the group. And
forcing them to kind of get kicked out of the nest, yeah.
The joke, because I'm the loon, but he really is in that sense. Like, he's faking it, right? But he's really faking it. He's
cuckoo. You know, it's also interesting, back to Chris Lloyd, is that in Back to the Future, he's actually a mad scientist. So it's, you could think of it, his character in Cuckoo's Nest was like some, you know, intermediary part of his life where he actually was in an asylum. And you could imagine later he went on to become the fabled Doc Brown. But actually, in part two, in Back to the Future 2, he the storyline changes when they travel back in time, and they actually have a newspaper that says Doc Brown is put into an insane asylum.
Yeah, Doc Brown committed, absolutely.
Yeah, so just drawing the two characters together again. And I could be wrong about this. It's been a really long time since I saw A Cuckoo's Nest, but when they go through, I'll have to watch it again just to verify, so don't take my word on this, but when they go through all the character intros, and by that I mean like when they show them for the first time, I remember looking for anything a little bit suspicious, and I couldn't find anything for most of the characters. But for Christopher Lloyd, if I'm right, when they show Christopher Lloyd for the first time in this movie, they pan like from his bedside, from where he's sleeping, onto the wall next to him. And on the wall next to him, I'm pretty sure is the Eye of Horus. I'm like 75% sure about it. I just remember being pretty blown away by it, like how they introduce them together. It's like graffiti on the side of a wall in the asylum, and it's like chilling next to his bedside. And so they show Chris, and they show this symbol in the graffiti.
That's pretty stunning.
Yeah. I mean, I could be totally off base because it's been a long time, like I said, but if I'm not, then there you have it.
Scott Crothers with Jack Nicholson is pretty priceless as Jack in an insane asylum.
Well, so I'm sure someone has caught this before, and it might even be a reference, but when you have Jack and Scatman Crothers together, it only happens for a few minutes in the movie. And Jack sneaks in the prostitutes, and they go into a bathroom. And the woman that Scatman Crothers is to sleep with, she falls into a bathtub, and she goes, "Do you mind if I take a bath?" And he goes, "As long as you don't drown your pretty little face in there," or something like that. Like, he's talking about the dead woman in the bathtub.
It's a real nice place you got here, Max.
Yeah, can I take a bath?
Sure, you can take a bath, sure. Just don't drown your pretty little self.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my, this room, are all these your guitars?
Wanna take a bath? It sounds exact. Yes. Oh, that was exactly what I thought about. The voice is the same. The voice is the same. She goes, "Hey, do you mind if I take a bath?" And it's like that, like, "Hey, you want to take a bath?" Oh my god, it's the same fucking voice.
The wall, obviously.
Thank you, sir. So you have the idea of if Christopher Lloyd shows up with this eye, and I understand, Joe, you're saying you don't want to commit to that 100% because it's been a while, but I'll definitely check that out. Something else I noticed was that there's a scene where Jack Nicholson walks past another piece of graffiti. It's when they're having the party at night, and everyone's getting drunk, and they're like kind of trashing the place. And someone wrote, it looks like in lipstick, but it's definitely like a red-orange text on the glass. They write, "Ha, ha, ha." And you only see it in like 1 second of the movie. Jack Nicholson walks behind the glass. So it's like you see Jack Nicholson with the words, "Ha, ha," written over his face. And I can't help but think of the Joker, who also goes into an insane asylum, who's also played by Jack Nicholson, etc., etc.
You know, the way they advertised, I've included this in a collage, and I didn't expect it to happen. I was just flipping it. The way that they advertised for Batman, the one with the Joker, they'd have this image that just said, "Ha."
Yes.
Flip it, and you put it against itself. It says, "Aha," because A and H both can be flipped without the letter. So, like, I don't know. That was a weird kind of moment that I had when I was like, oh, I want side by side. And I just ended up with an aha, like, oh, I get it. And then I think of like Crowley's aha. You know, have you ever read that before?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Our question mark thing where he says it all comes down to an exclamation mark, question mark. Yeah. Anyway,
what exactly is a joke?
What exactly is a joke? That was Syd Barrett's final lines contribution to Pink Floyd, which is a most likely to Stranger in a Strange Land when he's dealing with the apes and he's realizing the nature of a joke, because Syd Barrett was obsessed with that.
Joe, in your Sync Book 2 essay, you make the point that I thought was really profound. You say that the concept of synchronicity and humor, the where it goes together, is there's this something that a joke is sort of innately nonsensical, or there's a certain amount of lunacy in a joke.
Mm.
And that really strikes me.
Yeah, yeah.
It just really struck me as profound. I remember the first time I was reading your essay, and there's something there about, you know, obviously we're tying it into the Joker, and it's we're putting this in a slightly darker context, but it doesn't necessarily have to stay there, because there was this idea of humor, the importance of humor, and the sort of the good feeling of getting that joke or of laughing. And that synchronicity, what a lot of times people, a criticism I hear about synchromysticism is like, it's pattern recognition and you're releasing endorphins because you're so happy to make this other connection. That's like, you know, you're like looking for a pattern, you get one, you're like, oh, that syncs. It's kind of the same thing as that it releases some sort of endorphin, and that's why we're basically sync junkies. And I've heard this criticism a few times. But to me, when you're relating it to a joke, it seems more apt for me. Of like, well, of course it's going to release endorphins, and of course we want to laugh again, but is that a bad thing? Like, no one goes to a comedy club and they're like, oh, you people just want to laugh. No shit, uh-huh. You want to laugh.
Right. Yeah. I think I was mostly also trying to relate it to the idea that, like, you know, humor is good for our soul, or humor in general is maybe a little different than we think of it as. Like, you know, humor itself is significantly profound because, like, it lies on the fringe of logic. You know, things have to be loony in order to be funny, and so therefore they're really profound because they're just outside the realm of our comfort zone of thought, and so that makes humor actually like more important than logical thought, you could say. You know, it's like the bridge between your logical comfort zone of thought and you know, everywhere else. It's like I said, it could be seen as more important. So if sync is, you know, funny and embracing humor, then just like anything else that embraces humor, I think it makes it more profound. So
I know how much of comedy is an aspect of making funny observations of things. You know, it's like you're sort of recontextualizing something in a way that brings you some sort of happiness or joy.
Right, right. And that's perfect with like what David was saying about, well, just the whole ha and aha connection. You know, it's like finding something funny and finding something are so similar, even in the way that we express it, you know, like ha 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 and aha, like, ooh, I figured something out, or ooh, something's funny. It's almost like they're the same process. Like, I really think that, like, the mechanism which our brains allow us to think something is funny is, like, so closely related to the mechanism by which we figure things out.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the same. It's aha and ha ha ha, this is hilarious. You know, it's all the same thing.
The Zohar is just like loaded with jokes and commentary on the Zohar, especially. And the Torah itself has a ton of jokes that are like, there's pun jokes and there's like little clever things throughout it. And, you know, my teacher, when he was studying in Jerusalem, he would be with a group of rabbis studying, and he would laugh when something would come up and they wouldn't get the joke. But sure enough, that's a joke, but people can't get so serious. It's hard for them to recognize. And I think that the, I mean, there's, it's just because it's deep humor, you know, there's like deep, deep jokes in there. And so I find it funny. Also find funny that I'm looking here at Nurse Ratched's, Louise Fletcher's list of films that she's been in. I see she's in Firestarter, which is interesting. I want to watch that just for that reason. But the Southern Award for Brainstorm.
And what was, but, did you say Firestarter, the Drew Barrymore?
So you got her with DB 42, Firestarter, another Stephen King connected
that's,
to Shining.
That's fascinating to me because I was already thinking about Jack Nicholson as the Joker. He says, like, have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight? So here's this connection between dancing with the devil is kind of dancing through the flames, and then the moon as lunacy.
Yeah, she's in a movie called Tomb Junction. But the fire thing, Fool, and she, okay, so she's also in a film called Nobody's Fool, where she plays someone named Pearl. But what's interesting is that, I mean, I've said this many times, but from Latin, literally, and follis literally means bellows, right? So it's what you use to start a fire. And it also has the same word for the original German word for dollar. So where we get the word for dollar is the same etymological place where we get the word for what you use to start a fire and for someone to be a fool, which is why we say someone's full of hot air. This is why so funny when Private Joker in the latest Batman film keeps referring to Robin as a hothead over and over again. He's like, oh, he's hot. It's like he's connecting him with the fool in that way, because that's where that term comes from. But it's so fascinating that in Jack Nicholson in the original Batman has these hot air balloons, or these balloons, right, that he's got going in the air, that they shoot out gas and they start gassing everybody. Everyone's choking to death. And he's, while he's throwing out money. So not only do you have the full of air thing, but then you also have the money, and they're dying in front of the money. But then in the next one where you have Heath Ledger, he burns a pyramid of money. So not only do you have the money connected, but you also have it connected with fires. You have like all the etymological roots are there. And his whole thing is everything. And so that's super profound.
Well, if I may, that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, because just to quickly say, the reason I mentioned Drew Barrymore in connection with the moon is Jake Kotze actually made a film, a sync film, about Drew Barrymore's connection to the moon. So the fire starter is the moon resonator. Just want to point that out. But so you have the fool burning the money, all this sort of stuff. One of the things, and I like that you mentioned the hot air balloon, one of the things Joe and I talked about a few months ago over Facebook chats was this, I mentioned this on Always Record, that the cartoon Phantom Tollbooth, mm-hmm. when he goes from the human world, the live action world, into the cartoon, which is kind of like going into Toontown in Roger Rabbit, the toll booth says to him, mentions Rule 88, and he gets Rule 88 just as he goes through the Stargate into Toontown, and so it's connecting this to Back to the Future and all this sort of stuff. The character in Phantom Tollbooth is named Milo, who's voiced by, in Phantom Tollbooth, the main character's name is Milo. The kid who played Michael J. Fox, who played Marty in Back to the Future, who also goes 88 miles per hour through the Stargate, then voices a character named Milo in Disney's Atlantis. So you have this Milo connection. You have Milo going through in Phantom Tollbooth, and Milo is Michael J. Fox. What I realized about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is it's actually directed by a guy named Milo. So I was like, okay, this is very interesting. Now, Joe, I don't know if you got a chance to watch it, but I told you that Disney's Atlantis is actually, they took footage, they based a lot of their footage off of a cartoon that was made by The guy Miyazaki, you've probably seen his films like Spirited Away or Totoro or,
What is that? It's something, Nausicaä and the Valley of the Wind?
Nausicaä and the Valley of the Wind, yeah. Yeah, an amazing film in itself. So this guy Miyazaki made this film, which is called The Castle of Cagliostro. And so Disney, when they made Atlantis, they based footage in Atlantis off of Castle of Cagliostro. Now, Cagliostro is about this alchemist who is being challenged by a guy named Lupin, and his name means the wolf. So we have this serious connection. Why so serious? But Sirius, the dog star, wolf, blah, blah, blah. You have the idea that in that movie, Cagliostro makes all this counterfeit money, which they call goat bills, which is interesting, speaking of Oz, the word Oz meaning goat. So he makes these goat bills, which are counterfeit money. Lupin wants to steal the money. When he realizes it's all counterfeit, the end of the movie, he ends up burning all the money. So here we have this another connection to burning the money, the serious Joker, why so serious, burning the money. I also want to point out, when you mentioned the hot air balloons, is that one of the other things Joe and I talked about was in Phantom Tollbooth, we have this character called the Weatherman, who is one of the first people that Milo meets in this cartoon world. And his whole thing is about having this hot air balloon, and we were relating this to Oz, because obviously how does Dorothy try and get back from Oz but through the hot air balloon? So there's even a scene in there where he meets the Weatherman, and he also meets a witch named the Witch Witch, W-H-I-C-H, the Witch Witch, and I made the joke to Joe, was, are you a good witch or a bad witch?
And then Lloyd has, who knows which is which and who is who in that very scene.
Absolutely, yeah. So it might be a little convoluted chain of thought there, but there's something that's definitely coming full circle here with this Oz burning the money, fire.
So
yeah, it's so...
compelled to tell you. I just sent my friend a request to tell me what the specifics were, but I guess with that film, Nausicaä and the Valley of the Wind, it may have been just when it was released in the U.S., but I believe it was the producers of that film, two of them, are Trilateral and Bilderberg Group individuals, which was like, he knew their names as he was watching it and was like, wait, what? And like, because they're not, and they don't do films, like, but they did that. They did that.
Bear in mind, these were Japanese films that were redistributed by Disney for American audiences, and they had them all redone with American voices, which the American dubs are fucking terrible, and they rewrote the scripts to make them appropriate for American Disney audiences. So they really slaughtered these films. But there's also the idea that what is the Trilateral Commission is about bridging relations with Japan. So you have Disney, which is also already this mega corporation with all its connections to corporatism and whatnot. But it wouldn't surprise me to see how do you, if you're this mega corporation media empire and you want to find out what media can we rape from Japan, that you would use your Trilateral connections to get that.
Right. It's interesting. But then, within that story, like the nuclear element and some of the things at play, it's very curious. And the fact that it's the deep, like in Japan, I watched that film with a Japanese friend of mine, and I was glad I did, because it's like the whole thing you know, she was talking. I'm watching an English dub of it because that was what was available. And she was just telling me what all the differences were in the translations and how, like, I can't remember what they called it in English, but the place where those crazy, like, clefotic bugs live, like, that was literally the deep. And I was like, ooh, that's so much cooler than whatever it was. I don't know. It's like the forbidden zone in the film. It's kind of cool. Anyways, yeah. I like the idea of the counterfeit bills literally being obviously connected to Oz by being goat bills. That jumped out at me for sure.
Right. Plus, you guys have probably discussed it a lot on here, but you know how The Wizard of Oz at its core is really about money and fiat bills versus you know, the gold standard. So the connection is there from that sense too.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the idea of the Emerald City versus the Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah, just really weird implications considering that the film came out at the end of the Depression, but the books were written before it, which would imply somehow that the Theosophical Society was, you know, inner circle knowing the way that things are going to play out, that was actually strategy, which isn't that outrageous. But quite a statement.
Well, and in all fairness, it could also, it doesn't have to necessarily be that they would know how it's going to play out because they're in on it, but that they would know how it's going to play out because that was the obvious outcome of, you know,
right.
I mean, when you got to realize the Federal Reserve started in 1913 was not something that everyone was happy about. So to have somebody criticizing it and saying this is going to implode doesn't mean that you're in on a conspiracy to implode the currency. It could be a warning.
Specifics of how. So, like, I mean, it's represented in such an archetypal way that you have this gold road leading to the you know, emerald being the paper city. But I watched that Oz Great and Powerful, and it wasn't very good. But I'll tell you what, like, that whole scene where the one witch gets her emerald ring crushed and she turns into this decrepit, scary looking creature, meaning that it was the ring that was keeping her beauty. And then when you look at the fact that it's like, what is Emerald City surrounded around? But you have these, like, it's all emerald, like the whole city is having that done to it. Like if all the emerald was to be like the main emerald gem that's in the center of the city, like if that crushed, would the city just be like shit? And so that's like, take that as like goodbye Yellow Brick Road, where you have Elton John stepping into the picture and he's surrounded by like smog and destitution. You know what I'm saying?
Is this in the new movie? There's an emerald crystal at the center?
Well, yeah. There's like this main like area where it's just like these giant emeralds. And like,
because you know in Disney's Atlantis, isn't that's the concept, is there's a giant crystal that keeps the power of Atlantis in it?
Oh, I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, there's a basically the thing that keeps Atlantis alive is this big crystal at the center of Atlantis, and it's what they have to figure out basically how to use it to bring Atlantis back to the surface.
Wow.
But
so, just so you guys know, it's a really interesting synchronicity to play Goodbye Yellow Brick Road over The Wiz. And it started from when I think, I don't know, whatever it is, Motown fades out or whatever, but that's the first Motown Pictures film. And, yeah, it's very insightful. There's things in there that kind of blew my mind, so I'd recommend. The same.
Which in the Wiz, the Yellow Brick Road takes you to the World Trade Center, which is right next to, as we were discussing, it's right next to the World Financial Center, the lesser known complex right next to it. So basically, you have, and it's a few blocks away from Wall Street and all this sort of stuff. So if you know that area, the Wiz is by placing the Emerald City in downtown Manhattan, as it does, sort of reinforces the idea that this is a financial element to Oz, because it's going to the financial heart of Manhattan.
They make it no by the towers that the two towers are Joaquin and Boaz, so literally translated, established in strength. And so when they put that, when they have the sphere that's in between the two towers, which is symbolic of the Kaaba at Mecca, admittedly so, which they would rotate, and then they put the O and the Z for strength on that ball, they're literally telling you this is Joaquin and Boaz, and they keep panning up towards the two towers, and they have a link between them. They have a bridge between them, and out of that bridge, they shoot light down, and the light changes, and everyone who's dancing around the square, they all take on the light that's being projected from above, meaning that they're basically being like they're all in line with what the tower's projecting, like.
Oh, this is interesting. Is that so? And then obviously having the lion there, who is the strength card of the tarot, but also one of the things that I've had issue with a lot of the Oz film adaptations is they're always showing Emerald City as an actual Emerald City, whereas in the books they make the idea of it being counterfeit, specifically as a financial ruse, is made very evident because the Emerald City actually isn't emerald. When you go into Emerald City, you have to put on these green-tinted glasses, right, and they get locked onto your head so that you see everything as green, even though it's not really. It goes to the whole idea that the entire city is counterfeit. And you have to, if you don't allow them to essentially control your perception, you would see the illusion. So there's the idea that when you'd put it on, everything would be green. From an alchemical stance, that would make the lion a green lion, which is a heavy alchemical symbol in itself. But I just want to say here, you have the idea of this illusion being trapped in the illusion, but also having these goggles put over your eyes. I wonder if anyone makes any connection there to, say, like a modern 3D movie or anything like that, the idea of having to wear something to see what's trying to be shown to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that.
Again, I don't mean to paint it in a dark
I never
way.
Thought about... Oh.
Please, go ahead, man.
No, that's cool. Yeah, I never thought about this aspect of it before, but you know, in a way, like the brightness and the like a cheeriness of Oz itself, which it's always like portrayed as in whatever movie or book does the story. It's, you know, such a stark contrast to like where Dorothy comes from in Kansas, in that like she has really feeble beginnings. It's sort of a pale environment. She works on a farm. As opposed to in Oz, where everything is just sort of a fairy tale land. There's obviously an evil witch, but things are generally more happy. And you could think of it as more of like a utopia compared to where she comes from, where everybody's working. So it's almost like, you know, in order to go to this land of utopia, you have to be willing to let these rulers behind the curtain, you know, make you wear those glasses and alter your perception and shine the light down on everybody, the colored light, and have them dance to whatever tune the rulers want them to dance to. And, you know, maybe the idea is for anybody who picks up on it that, yeah, everybody's dancing to the tune of these rulers who are behind the curtain, and it's all an illusion. But in turn, all the people dancing are granted entry into this utopia. So it's like a, you know, almost an even exchange by that token. You get to live in this fantasy utopia. You get extracted from your life on a farm where you have, you know, hard labor. But in exchange, you have to play their game. You have to play their money game. You have to buy into their fake illusion monetary system. So.
Absolutely, yeah. Will Morgan brought to my attention, there's this new movie with Jodie Foster coming out. I don't know, maybe it already came out. Basically, that's the whole plot of it. Because I was told this idea, and this is something I'd like to bring up with you, Joe, is I've been really kind of meditating on this idea of time travel and the underworld. And which, of course, we can make the connection here that Oz, we refer to Australia as Oz, which we also refer to it as the land down under, which makes it an underworld or land of the dead, at least for Northern Hemisphere culture. So that Oz would already resonate an underworld for us. But one of the things that I've been really meditating on is this idea of time travel connected to the underworld. So this movie that Jodie Foster's in, so we have Jodie Foster as the basically continuation of Dave Bowman, the 2001. She's Arrowway. And obviously the movie Contact is based off of the film 2001 A Space Odyssey. So we have her as this contact resonator who actually gets inside a sphere to travel, and she thinks she's traveling across all this space, and what does she actually do is she confronts her dead father. And even though that's somewhat of an illusion, it's the alien saying, I had to take on the guise of your father as to not to startle you. In a sense, she's going to the land of the dead. By going to a place where she can see her dead father. But I've also been thinking the idea that Marty McFly, or any time travel story, where to go back in time, you would be to go back to a place where the dead are, where you can make contact with the dead. So when Marty goes back to 1955, obviously his parents aren't dead in the 80s. But let's say his grandparents or different things like that. He's definitely interacting with the dead by going back in time. I had talked about the idea that in Donnie Darko, they open a Stargate on the movie screen, which obviously people have made the idea that 2001 A Space Odyssey, the monolith is the movie screen. The movie screen is the Stargate. In Donnie Darko, we have, again, another rabbit. We have a portal opening on the movie screen. The portal is opening on a film called The Evil Dead. So we have the idea of the land of the dead coming through. Donnie Darko, actually, the whole plot of Donnie Darko is that he goes into this tangent universe, but all the people there are essentially dead, and he has to time travel back and kind of correct the timeline. So he descends into the underworld, opens this portal on the movie screen, and then has to time travel. So all these things are very much connected for me. And I could go into it further, but I've discussed this over the last few weeks and always record. I just kind of want to get in, bring this up with you, Joe, to see if this speaks to it all, because even in Back to the Future, when the lightning strikes him, he's aimed at the movie theater. So he's essentially, we see him driving towards the movie theater, the lightning strikes him, and he disappears. It's almost like he goes through the movie screen. Jason pointed out that even in I think it's Back to the Future 3, when he time travels back to the American West, he's at a drive-in movie theater. So we have him kind of going through the screen again. I'm just curious, and again, I'm sorry, I hope no one's seeing this in a particularly dark flavor. I want to use this metaphor of time travel, underworld, Oz. I want to see if this does anything for you.
Yeah, for me, that's as powerful as it gets. I mean, he's driving towards the movie theater, and then in 3, he drives to the movie screen. You know, I'm pretty rooted in associating, you know, the screen or, you know, the iPhone or TVs with the monolith, obviously, as I think a lot of people assume it was intended to be. So for me, that just adds like just a lot of context to that whole already thick situation where Marty's and with the clock tower time traveling. I never thought of that. I mean, that's pretty profound. He drives right towards the movie theater. It's like he's driving into the TV. It's incredible, actually. I don't know what to say. I love it.
Well, I guess here's the question that's been raised, though. So quick context here, and sorry to restate assumptions for regular listeners, but quick context is that the gentleman William Crookes, who invented the Crookes tube, was trying to scry. He was trying to contact spirits using a mirror, a black mirror. He was trying to contact spirits, and in this process, he ends up inventing the Crookes tube, which leads to the invention of the television. So here we have something that was being – the guy was trying to contact spirits of the dead, and he ends up developing the television. So we already have this idea of spirits coming through, kind of like a poltergeist scenario, right, where she's looking at the television and saying they're here, that the spirits would come through. But one of the things that I've really been thinking about is the idea of do we have – and it depends how literal you want to take any of this. Obviously, we can. I know most of us are just like to keep this as a metaphor, but I want to ask if the distinction needs to be made. We have the concept of spirits coming out of the screen, and then we also have the idea of going into the screen, the sort of into the illusion, going into Toontown, that sort of stuff. Do we make a distinction between something coming out or someone going in?
Right, and I guess you could think of going into it, if not literally, you know, traveling into the screen, but just watching it, you know, your consciousness going into it. So staring at the screen is kind of like venturing into the spirit world. In that sense, you know, you're just by looking at the screen, you're traveling to the dead. And to take it a little more literal, I mean, the screen really portrays in the best method that we know people who are dead in, you know, all their likeness, meaning like if you were to try to contact somebody who's dead, it's difficult to do it by looking at a picture of them or reading their journal or hearing stories about them to really, you know, get a feeling for what they were like or to experience them in the best way is to watch them on a TV projection screen of them. So I know that's not where you're going with
no,
this.
No, it's absolutely, because media, right, it's basically who contacts spirits, but a medium is someone who's able to contact spirits.
Yes.
And then you have the idea that the only way, if I want to get in touch with what Confucius thought or felt, I would have to read his words. So I would need some sort of media or medium to contact his spirit or his intelligence. Is the most common way, absolutely. And there's even, I was talking to someone after watching 2001 and having a similar kind of conversation, because this is where it all started for me. It was a few weeks ago, watching 2001 on the big screen. And when I was saying this, woman said to me, she goes, that's interesting because you have the, like, Amish idea of someone taking a photo is stealing a bit of your soul. And then she mentioned the idea that whatever, when you're looking at images on a screen, you would be looking at essentially dead images. And then there's also a point that Andras Jones has made to me many times, is that capturing a moment on film or even audio or whatever, and then I think we'd have to include writing in this, is a form of time travel, because you've captured that moment and you can revisit that moment. So if we record this conversation today, and in a year we want to time travel back to August 8th, 2013, we would listen to this episode. In a sense, you are at least partially time traveling to that time.
Right. And hopefully, as the media evolves, our ability to, you know, to time travel through media will just continue to evolve as well. You know, I'm sure people who looked at photographs back in the day felt like they were you know, having that sensation of time traveling or getting to know these dead people. And now we can have it in a more profound sense now, like even to the point where sometimes you've probably had this happen to you, but like if you watch a movie of an actor who's since been deceased, sometimes like halfway through the movie, you kind of think to yourself like, oh my God, I can't believe this person's actually dead. You know, I almost forgot, or, you know, they seem so real to me. Especially actors who have like recently died, you kind of have to almost like wake up and say like, I can't believe they're really dead. Like, you know, I can see them. It's just crazy to think that, because they feel so alive when I'm watching them through this advanced media of a TV. So, you know, obviously our media are going to continue to evolve. So it's like, maybe at some point people who are captured on those future advanced media won't ever really feel dead. You know, it won't ever seem like they're gone. Like, I'm thinking of the movie, the new version of the Time Machine. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. I forget who directed it or who's in it, but I'm sure you guys have seen it before. And the media in that is like a librarian who is a hologram and looks just like a human being. I'm sure you guys know what I'm talking about.
I actually haven't seen that. But it's based off the H.G. Wells Time Machine.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, I won't go on to that tangent.
No, please, then, please, because this is actually... Please actually just tell me, because the idea of a librarian fits right in with what I've been thinking about. It's the idea I'll just quickly say, is that the idea that, you know, what do we say about a good book? We say a good book actually transports you to a place, or you know, you get so wrapped up in the story. But it's the idea of a piece of media as your transportation. Right. That it can, it's basically a teleportation or a time travel. All these things kind of blur together, but it's a very common phrase for many, many, many years that a good book will transport you somewhere else. And to me, the idea of, you know, we usually talk about movies and stuff here, but a movie is just an extension of the written word in the sense of being more media.
Right. Yeah, it's more information encoded. I think that's obvious. You know, like the just written media it has a limitation of how much information it can encode as far as us experiencing it back. But, you know, the future ones will, or the future forms of media will hopefully just have almost as much information encoded as our five sense experience would allow us to have in the present moment. And, so yeah, I like that blurring of the lines between, are we time traveling? Are we going into the underworld to meet dead people? Or are we just experiencing a piece of media that has encoded so much information that the difference between the present and the past is now obsolete? You know, it doesn't matter. And I can even imagine like a scenario where children who grow up with this have a hard time envisioning like a period of human history where the past and the present weren't one, because they can experience it so seamlessly because all the information is encoded in an advanced type of media, so they can experience the past as if it were the present. And maybe they intuitively understand and can make the distinction, but to them it's just a moot point. You know, they don't care if it was in the past, if it was in the underworld. It's suddenly become joined with the present, so and obviously allowed to happen through media.
I ran an experiment yesterday after our talk with Mark LeClaire of watching Poltergeist and 2001: A Space Odyssey simultaneously, and kind of like visualizing what they would look like if I was to overlay them, and it was. I got halfway through it just because I had other stuff to do. But there's a really interesting point at which the actual scene where the television set reads 237 and the spirit actually comes out of the television as a hand and then goes into the wall, the point at which it goes into the wall, if you overlay it, starting it at the, so they're both MGM films, so if you start them at the exact moment that MGM fades out for both of them, the point at which that lands on Poltergeist is the same point at which the Hilton Hotel thing is there in the corner. And so if you were to overlay them, it would actually mean that the Poltergeist was literally shooting into exactly the point where it says Hilton. Which is really freaky considering that that's like a real example of like time projection, because obviously the Millennium Hilton that stood in front of the two towers was made as a model of the monolith, admittedly so. And so the fact that it's the Millennium Hilton, the fact that you're watching 2001, A Space Odyssey, every element there is there. And I've been looking at 2001, because of the mirroring that goes on as kind of a representation of the cliphotic tree as a mirror of Tetragrammaton as the four worlds reverse. And so that was kind of weird.
Yeah, it's like the hand flies out of the TV monolith and into the Hilton monolith.
Correct. It was a direct hit. So, and then both films are doing the same thing. Like when they kick their television set out at the end, the last room that they show you when they're scanning down the corridor of the motel that they check into at the end of Poltergeist, the last door that you can see is 217, which we know is the number of 237 in the book, The Shining, which is kind of weird. But the fact that they're kicking their television set out is this whole thing that you, and then you're back up. On the screen, you're backing up from this motel. It's a joke because you are watching fucking television and they know you're going to be watching this on your television set. And so it's like you're inviting spirits into your home by doing so. And that's the whole point. And not just, I mean, the amount of Kabbalistic references in 2001 and Poltergeist are both off the fucking Richter. Like, there's so many, and they're, in my opinion, very overt. I you know, so it's interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. That's really, really awesome. Unfortunately, I'm not as familiar with Poltergeist, but I wish I was right now.
The reason why I felt obliged to do that, the timing isn't exactly the same, but I was curious if it would, I have to try it again, because I'm curious if the film will actually end right before the intermission, which is what I'm hoping for. I need to check that out, but I have...
Oh, so you haven't finished watching them overlaid.
Halfway through it, and then I have stuff to do, but I felt inspired. I recently had an experience where I watched, I'm going to try and do this quickly because I've said it before and always record, but well, I guess a lot of the things I say I said before or whatever. I watched Alien with The Gray, not realizing multiple things. First, I watched with the director's cut of Alien, not realizing I was watching with the director's cut of Alien, which is only like 3 minutes at. And so I'm like, well, close to being exact. I was like that, and then I like look at it and I'm like, oh, the director's cut, I wonder how long the regular cut is. And then when I watch it with the regular cut simultaneously starting from the point at which the production fade out, so it's the actual beginning of the film, it ends, they both end on the same second, so The Gray and Alien are the exact same time completely. And I did not realize that it was produced by Tony Scott and Ridley Scott. The Gray was. And so there's that connection. I also did not know that Tony Scott jumped off of a bridge in L.A. within 3 months of the film's release, and that the film itself, if you watch it, it's an overt suicide note. Look at the music score to the film. The first one is... what is it? I think it's called Suicide, and it's called The Note. The second one is The Suicide, and then you have The Memorial or something along those lines in there. It's like, it's very, you can see that it's a suicide note, and that the fact that it's The Gray is meant to tie in with Alien. I feel like this is an example of something that's, I mean, it could just be the workings of the psychedelic universe, but that would be the Hoffman's Razor explanation. I feel like the Occam's Razor explanation is that it's intended. So yeah, very weird.
Yeah, that's probably the highest form of art I've ever heard of, is to leave a suicide note in the form of a major Hollywood movie.
Yeah. His name's Tony Scott, and then he died. He kills himself on Bicycle Day. So he kills himself on Hoffman's LSD Discovery Day, which is interesting because Tony is Anthony, which is, you know, St. Anthony is a saint of ergot poisoning. And so there's this really weird, like, psychedelic side to that. And so I overlaid the films with Adobe Premiere And it does, like, it's the closest thing to an ayahuasca trip I've ever seen represented in film is when you have 50% transparency viewing those two films. It's crazy. So.
Yeah. Oh, so you actually overlay them on top of each other while you're watching. I had the impression that you were watching them on separate screens.
Watch them on separate screens, but then I went to the trouble to overlay them, rendering and encoding. But though it works, it's not as high quality as I want. I need to get a computer that can handle what I need in order to maintain the timing of the specifically the voices, to have the voice be completely in line. And it goes off a little bit with one of them, and so whatever. I just have a standard, and it didn't meet my standard. So, but
right, yeah. Right. You know what might be an interesting study would be to somehow, instead of monitoring like the overlapping direct content of the films, but somehow monitoring like the brain activity of the person watching it. So if you were to say like, well, we watched these two films synced up, but instead of watching the films, you just had two computers monitor like with wires or whatever, however it's done, you know, the brain activity of the people watching it and see if what they feel or think somehow matches up.
Yeah.
Isn't that what's done in like Poltergeist 2 or Exorcist 2? I don't know. Now I'm confusing my things. Where I think it's Exorcist 2, where
that's Nurse.
What's that?
Nurse Ratched.
Yeah. Oh, well, exactly. Yeah. I'm saying it's the like someone coming in and saying, you know, let's monitor your is what they actually do.
Oh, is it?
No, I mean I'm not. Oh, God, there's even you ever see the God, I think it's called Return to Oz. It's a live action Oz movie from like the 80s. By any chance, has anyone seen that?
I think that I have, but I can't remember.
Okay, it's actually really good, but it starts off with Dorothy basically going to a psychiatrist and she to find out if she's crazy or not, because she keeps talking about this place Oz she went to, and they're like, "Oh, you're fucking crazy." And what's really interesting is they're about to do electroshock therapy on her. And it's the moment that they do electroshock therapy on her is like lightning, the storm comes, and she gets whisked away to Oz. And it's really, there's a sort of subtle like, is she disassociating? You know, is she like going to this electroshock that like she's so afraid that she like retreats back inside her mind into the land of Oz? Or does she actually get saved? It's actually an interesting little play there. excuse me. But because in Cuckoo's Nest, there's also the where they go for the electroshock therapy and all this sort of stuff. But just the whole idea of, you know, is someone crazy? Are they, you know, can we actually trust their perception, et cetera, I think is pretty fascinating overlap here.
So, Dr.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
Okay. So, the actress who plays Nurse Ratched is Dr. Tussin in The Heretic, Exorcist 2. And she's the one who hypnotizes the girl to whom she is liked by a synchronizer, a biofeedback device used by two people to synchronize their brainwaves. So, that's Ratched that does that.
Perfect.
Okay.
I'm also kind of thinking or trying to imagine what the experience would be like for actors who are now having to adjust to the new CGI world that they've now like been thrust into. Because I was recently watching like a quick commercial for the new Percy Jackson movie, and he was saying, you know, filming was fun. It was just business as usual, a ton of green screens and one or two real props. And they show the shot of them in the studio where it's, you know, him and two actors in a car surrounded by just green material everywhere. And I can't help but think that, you know, they're sort of part, as actors, they're sort of part of the conspiracy of Emerald City, where, you know, they're pulling this green wool over everybody's eyes. And it's like, as the media is evolving and as CGI is getting better, and as TV and is getting better at fooling the people who are watching it, it's all merging with this this counterfeit Emerald City theme, where you know, all their creations, meaning like all the scenes that they film and all the magical feats that they seem to be going out and achieving, are just this this counterfeit emerald emerald washed illusion. So that's all.
Yeah.
Huh. So let's bring this, if we can, for a moment, to Back to the Future, or just Christopher Lloyd. There were some things that I brought to your, or I thought I was bringing to your attention, Joe, that you said you actually had looked into. There is a some weird like video game that Christopher Lloyd voiced a character in, and it's basically about an animator who gets pulled into his animation world. It's again getting pulled into Toontown. When I like when you said, are the actors part of the, again, it doesn't have to be like actual like conspiracy like a lot of people think, but the sort of unconscious conspiracy to pull us into illusion, or even to wake us up from illusion, if you want to take it that way. But just the idea of the illusion makers, the media makers, in this, the idea that the animator gets pulled into his animated world, and one of the first things he sees is a UFO. This struck me because we in one of your videos, you make the point that the DeLorean for the people in the 1950s, when they see this flying DeLorean, they would have to think of it as a UFO. Even in the first one, they think he's a man from Pluto. They think it's a UFO. So it's the idea that Marty is piloting a UFO, or Marty is an alien, et cetera, et cetera. And then here we have Christopher Lloyd kind of bringing all these things together, where it's like you have a man going into the Toontown, meeting Christopher Lloyd, seeing a UFO. And I also can't help but think of the movie They Live, which has these, which is of all about projecting the illusion, right? They've created this sort of false hologram around everybody. It's not exactly like Matrix, but it kind of is. And those aliens are kind of like zombies. And I believe in the original book that it's based off of, they're reptilians, but there's always this sort of weird overlap between them being aliens but also being dead. And it's Violator, Jeremy Violator, makes the point that the same prop that's used in They Live, where they go, when they first go into the alien world, there's this prop, which is the exact same prop that was used in Ghostbusters as the PKE meter. So we have this connection between the dead and the aliens again. I'm just curious, what was in these other Christopher Lloyd threads that you didn't really find the need to work into a video, what were some of the things that you came across that maybe it's easier just to kind of talk about them here and not have to make a whole video about?
Yeah, well, the game that you're talking about is called Toonstruck, and I thought that it like followed Lloyd's archetype or the themes that surround him to a T. I didn't want to put in the video because honestly, or any of them, because it's just so thick, and also because it's not a major motion picture that too many people would be familiar with, so I thought people would get lost by it, but I'll just quickly sum it up. Basically, he's an animator in the real world, and his name is Drew Blank, which obviously is pertaining to his writer's block, but his initials are DB for Drew Blank, like Doc Brown. And what happens is he's up late at night trying to write a story about a fluffy bunny, essentially. And while dreaming about the rabbit, he gets sucked into this wormhole. It's like this spiraling tornado thing that pulls him right into the TV that's next to him. So it's just a really thick theme of following this rabbit down this wormhole. And when he gets to the land of Toons, which is obviously really similar to what he's done in the past in, Page Master, Entering Oz, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. He's also in at the end of the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland. But anyway, so he gets sucked into this land of Toons by following this white rabbit. Sorry, by following a rabbit. And he's actually there on a mission to save the land of the Toons by building a UFO. That's sort of his mission. There's an evil UFO that's already existing there that tries to hurt him and tries to strike him with lightning and all this crazy stuff in between. But basically he has to construct a UFO, which is pretty similar to his job in Back to the Future. And yeah, it's a pretty interesting journey, I guess you could call it. So it's called Toonstruck. It's a cartoon. I mean, it's a video game, but it's got a lot of cartoon movies inserted into the game. So you can watch those on YouTube if anybody wants to.
Have you seen, there was a movie that Will Morgan brought to my attention. It was called Highway 66 or not. It's not actually what it's called, but it's
You haven't seen Interstate 60?
Yeah, Interstate 60. Thank you. Yes, that's what it's called. That's what it's called. Yeah, I was asking if you've seen that. I'm, yeah, that's – Will Morgan brought –
Have you seen it?
I have seen it. Will Morgan
brought – Or David? Oh, you have. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
Will Morgan basically wanted everyone – he sent me an email. This is probably a few years ago. It was all right, everyone has to watch this movie. And it was pretty intense.
Yeah. I don't like to, fly off the handle and getting too excited about things, but Interstate 60 is one of those movies that I would second Will on and say, man, everyone who hasn't seen it needs to watch it. I felt like just like the experience of watching this movie was transcendent. I didn't even have to sit and reflect on it afterwards to get that feeling. Just watching it itself was pretty remarkable. So I definitely recommend it. Very highly.
Yeah, it wasn't a great movie or anything, but it just brought all these things together pretty intensely. And the fact that Christopher Lloyd is basically, you have them going through a tunnel again, and that they find Christopher Lloyd essentially at the end of the trip. I don't want to give it all away or anything, but it's pretty... it's pretty mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's
pretty fascinating. Yeah, how, and it makes me wonder if, does Christopher Lloyd have, how much intentionality does he have? How much is he typecast? Because apparently he's going to be in a movie now, which is called Time Master or something like that. Master of Time and Space.
Across the Fourth Dimension. Yeah.